Welcome to episode 136 of the Atomic Powered Supercast with your hosts Andrew, David, and Jen. This week, we read Teen Titans Judas Contract by Marv Wolfman. And now, the cast begins.
Okay, everybody, welcome to another hateful episode of the Atomic Powered Supercast. Because of Tara.
Yeah, no, I get it.
Yeah, my name is Andy, and I'm hanging out with David.
Hey.
And Jen.
Hate.
Because at first it sounded like, hey, but then it wasn't.
It was actually
tricked you.
So we're starting up a new series, Teen Titans. So we're starting with the old stuff. Next week we're going to move to the new stuff, and then we're going to do the animated stuff. So this
technically,
week...
This is the new stuff, because this is New Teen Titans.
Yes, this is New Teen Titans. It's a trade paperback.
From the 80s.
Yeah, called Judas Contract. It collects issues number 39 to 44 of the run written by Marv Wolfman, along with annual number 3.
Art by George Perez.
All right, that's right. Art by George Perez. Got to cite that artist, because we're going to talk about it, so we might as well say who did it. So how did you guys feel about this classic of the Teen Titans lore?
So this is the first time I've read any of the new Teen Titans, but I am familiar with this story because it's in the cartoon, which we're gonna watch the cartoon in two episodes from now. So it was interesting for me to kind of compare the two, especially comparing Tara.
Mm-hmm.
But my overall feel of this comic is that it's pretty dated. I get that it's like a really important story as far as the Teen Titans go, but something I just couldn't get over the fact I just couldn't get over how dated it felt.
Like what were some specific things that made it feel dated to you?
Oh God.
Other than the Mr. T references and the Michael Jackson call-outs.
Yeah, well, there were those. Michael Jackson, Mr. T, Star Wars, where I caught all those in there. But just, like, the way that the characters talked, I guess the dialogue made it felt dated. Like, everybody was calling each other different nicknames. And I've read other comics from the 80s, and I felt like... That's not something you get on a regular basis. I read, like, Crisis on Infinite Earths is, like, to me, one of the biggest comics of the 80s.
Yeah.
Or even Days of the Future Past. We didn't read that too long ago. Those didn't have these kind of... Those weren't so quippy. And I feel like those are definitely... Those are both serious comics. Especially Days of the Future Past, Crisis on Infinite Earths, Supergirl dies, Barry Allen dies. There's some big, huge changes to the DC Universe in those comics. This is also Judas Contract is also a pretty serious comic, I think, especially mm-hmm. with the kind of topics that are covered here. Betrayal, loss of self in regards to Deathstroke.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like a squad of Peter Parkers.
Not even.
But it's worse. Like,
I think the nicknames come off extra bad because to me it doesn't feel like it's the dating it. The nicknames, it comes off as like an older writer trying to sound hip.
Well,
yes.
Okay,
and
so
that makes the interaction like feel really awkward.
It feels forced.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like natural things to say about one to people. Like, they all have nicknames, like...
Golden Legs.
Green Jeans.
Yeah.
Or Rust, what is it, Rust Head for Cyborg? It's
yeah.
Like, it's just like they weren't...
No pants.
it was pretty distracting.
Yeah, every time it happened, it pulls you away a little bit.
So, I have to say, not having read or watched Teen Titans at all, I actually had to go to the wiki to figure out what people's names were. And this was around chapter 7. I finally got fed up and I was like, I'm not sure which one Logan is or, you know, who Gar is. And apparently the same person,
yeah,
but I couldn't figure Logan that out. So that was super problematic, I think. And I mean, it's not just that they each have one cheesy nickname. It's like Wonder Girl is called Wonder Girl 1D WG, like
Donna.
Wonder. Well, yeah, Donna's her name too.
Yeah.
Like, but there were like maybe five or six different plays on Wonder Girl, and it's like stick with one.
So, are there any names that you didn't figure out by the end, like who was what?
If I didn't have the wiki, I would not have figured out Beast Boy's name. And I still can't remember what his name in Teen Titans is. I only remember from Doom Patrol. I wouldn't have known the cyborg guy's name.
No, yeah.
Let's see. I think those were, like, the two main problematic ones. Everyone else was pretty clear. And, I mean, I already knew who Wonder Girl and Dick Grayson were. That wasn't a problem. But,
yeah, well, and talking about, like, the serious themes and talking about Dick Grayson, I mean, there's the serious themes of, like, betrayal and loss of sense of self and all of those sorts of things, but there's the more positive themes that you would expect to be associated with Teen Titans, like growth and change. Like, I think it's really, like, man, watching WALL-E in the first issue of this, and I don't know if it was first issue or the annual or what, but did you guys read the issue where WALL-E left the team?
Yeah, I think that was the first issue.
Okay, yeah. Because
it was the trade, right? The issues weren't called out in the trade.
I read somewhere that Tara dies in annual number 3, which means that must have been the last one.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, yeah. All right. Then good now. Then that, I'm sure on the order now. But like, it was really interesting to see WALL-E in that stage of development after having read the Flash series and seeing what WALL-E becomes. And it's like, wow. These characters on this title really do grow, and they really do change. And, like, reading that with WALL-E made me understand why there are people who are attached to the Titans and, like, latch onto these characters in a way that people don't with other characters. Like, we see WALL-E grow. If you read Titans and then you read Flash, like, you have an attachment to WALL-E that you can't have for Batman because you've seen him go through this growth and change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I was like, I know he wasn't part of the story, but I wanted to talk about that because I know there are people who are Teen Titans fans who are like fanatical over this team. And now I kind of understand why, because you see these people go through this.
So I'm going to back up a little bit, going back to your original question of what I thought about this. I guess I'm being a little unfair by starting out with the negative thing, because I guess I liked the comic. But there were just, like, I enjoyed the story overall, but like I said, there were these things like the nicknames in particular, like you said, Andy, it pulled me out of the comic a little bit. But now that I've kind of digested it and I'm thinking back about it and listening to what you guys have to say about the comic, I definitely agree with what you're saying. And I think, especially the point about watching characters grow, that's something, like you use Batman as an example. But I can't really think of another example. X-Men. I don't know if you guys read the introduction to the trade, but Marv Wolfman and George Perez both mentioned that their comic, when New Teen Titans came out in 1980, they were compared to Chris Claremont's X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
And I can definitely see the similarities to it. I think they even I seem to remember something in here about somebody being a mutant?
Jericho.
And how mutants are popular or something. Like, I think they took a little...
They took a little jab.
To X-Men when they were talking about mutants. But there aren't a lot of comics like this where you can see the characters grow. And I think that Teen Titans, the characters here are especially... It's even more pronounced than with X-Men because... They kind of graduate from the team they're in, right? They start out as sidekicks, some of them. Well, at least with WALL-E and Dick, they start out as, then they go to their own team, and then they graduate from their own team into their next role. You know, Dick becomes Nightwing, and then Nightwing gets his own book, and then eventually becomes Batman for a little while. Cyborg is now part of the Justice League, even though one could argue it's a different universe because it wasn't until the New 52. But it is a growth point for the character overall. Moved from continuity, it's a new role for this character, and it's a growth role because now he's in the big leagues, right? I mean, Justice League, that's they're the headline team of DC, and I would argue that they're the superhero
version of making it.
Yeah, and I'd say that the Justice League, even though they don't have a movie or anything, they're bigger than the Avengers. I would say, and I'm a huge Avengers fan. So even though you know, like I said, there's similarities between them and the X-Men, it's kind of taken to the next level here. We say that with Flash too, because like you mentioned, Wally becomes Flash, and it's kind of sad now that he is, even before New 52, he kind of got demoted after Barry came back. But it was that the way he was like written out of comics. Even though it's kind of unfair because there's lots of people who love Wally, it was him growing. He moved on from superheroics to focus on being a
father.
Yeah, to be a father and a husband and whatever else that he's gonna do.
Mechanic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah. Go ahead. I talked for a long time there.
I was gonna say you mentioned Dick Grayson too, and we see him. I don't know about grow, but we definitely see him change. He's accepted the fact that, I mean, you get the sense in the beginning of this book that he's the leader of the Teen Titans and he calls himself Robin still, but that's not really what his role is. Like, Robin, he locks onto this too. Like, it's the name of a sidekick. It's not the name of a leader of a team. It's not the name of a person who's not a sidekick anymore. Like, at this point, Batman has another Robin. There's the Robin that's Dick Grayson, and there's this other Robin that's the sidekick of Batman. And he's like, aside from the fact there's another one, it's not my role anymore. That's not who I am, and I'm just holding on to it like a safety blanket. And he says at a certain point, I have to graduate from this. I have to be what I am, and I have to accept it, you know? And then we get that really awkward strip scene.
Yeah, he was shedding his kid clothes.
Dude, and as he was taking it off, I was sitting there thinking, you can get naked, bro?
He said then, he wasn't, like, twice. Yeah.
And then Tara says it, too.
You know what's interesting? Like, oh, I never realized that he was. It was like a unitard that he was wearing underneath his collared shirt thing.
Yeah, I thought it was, like, all one thing. I didn't realize it was, like, a unitard and then a tunic and then, like, a belt and, like, there's layers to it.
Yeah.
I was like, damn, you did acrobatics and all of that? Holy crap. How did you do that, Dick?
We're adults.
I mean, but yeah, it's interesting how you get this change that you don't get in other books or in other heroes too.
I mean, you see characters grow, but this is like literal growth, like aging, becoming adults, and that's something you don't see very often.
Yeah.
In this comic, too, especially in the case of Dick Grayson, you kind of see, like, this transition period. It's almost like he's clearly in between being a kid and an adult, which, mm-hmm. you know, that's what being a teenager is.
Yeah.
But he, at first, maybe it seems like bad writing. It seems very lumpy because at times Dick Grayson thinks these very mature things, his process is very mature. You know, when he hunts down Slade going after each of the Teen Titans, for instance, he thinks rationally and clearly like an adult. But sometimes the shit that comes out of his mouth is dumb kid shit. Like when Slade's wife tells him the story and he's just like, you expect me to believe that? And it's like, well, everything she said was actually completely reasonable. You know, and then he's kind of mean to Jericho for no reason. And I mean, it's a bad position for him, but you can actually see him working out his aggression in a negative way towards other people in a very childlike manner. And like the quips are kind of childlike, too. It's he does that less and less as he becomes more serious Nightwing. And at the same time, I think it also kind of reflects comics writing as a whole, because these are a set of characters that we get to see grow up at the same time comics become more gritty, right? So, you know, we start getting, like, really dark stories about drug abuse and people dying, and, you know, Batman becomes a lot darker. It's no longer campy fun. Mm. And these characters grow out at the same time from being kids and being cute and campy. And that is, like, my main adjective for this comic. This was really campy to me. And they start growing out of that, and by the time we hit the 90s, we see them in their adult roles. You know, Dick Grayson as Nightwing dealing with crime syndicates, or we see Wally West having to deal with his problems as an adult. And I think this, it's a very dated piece, but it's also very timely, because it hits just that right time where we are in a transitory phase for comics. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know, like, if you read something nowadays with Garfield in it, it's night and day. If you consider that this is the person he used to be, like, when Robin leaves, he becomes the leader of the team. And, like, his personality just, and it's like, I think the only people who stay on the team really are him and Raven. And, like the team, because they're inexperienced, they get losses along the way. They have really bad shit happen to them, and it's like, there's all this tragedy that surrounds the team by the time you get to the early aughts, and Garfield's, like, the only one. He's been there for all of it. And, like, you see him, like, just mature so much over that time.
I mean, you have to. Because if you think about it, like, Wally leaves, right?
Sorry, I was going to say, you have to mature if you start out here with Garfield.
Yeah, seriously. Oh, God. He's something.
He's the fucking worst and the best all at the same time.
But it's like, you know, if you look at the team around him, I think Raven goes through several incarnations. She's thought to be dead at some point. I think he later has a romance with her, right?
Yeah, I think so.
And, like, that's got to affect him. Donna dies.
Mm-hmm.
And then Wally leaves.
Donna comes back during Infinite Crisis.
Yeah.
Well, everyone comes back.
Well, she comes back because reality was punched.
Yeah. Because that's the best it's the best explanation in comics writing.
It's pretty ridiculous that that's a thing, but.
And yeah. I wish I were exacerbating or making a joke of it, but that's exactly what happens.
What happened?
We should read that. We'll have to read Infinite Crisis one of these days.
Yeah.
But basically, Superboy Prime gets mad and punches the universe. that's how we get the 52. So Infinite Crisis leads directly into 52.
Yeah.
And there's 52 universes because
when he punches reality, it shatters into 52 pieces. So, okay. Let's
back
talk
to
about this
things.
Comic. So, I mean, the thing is, we talk about them as a team and a growth and that sort of thing, but I think if they're really going to grow on the team book, it has to be about the characters and the interactions between them. And I think that's kind of why we get a lot of weirdness with the nicknames. If it's supposed to be about the interaction between them, then you really need to focus on that when you're reading it. And if their interactions are stunted by those nicknames, it pulls you out of the very thing that's supposed to be drawing you in. And I think that's why we're harping on the nickname thing, because that's like, it's a team book. The important thing is the team interaction between the characters and whenever they interact. You're like, what is this nickname? This is so stupid.
Okay, one thing that really got me was the way that some of them talked, especially Tara. She's supposed to be so bad, right? She smokes, she's sleeping with, like, a 50-year-old dude, and she talks like one of those freaking kids who hangs out with Jimmy Olsen, the newsboy crew or whatever the hell they're called, right? And it's like, I think this is it. Certain swear words have become a lot more acceptable to just be bandied about in the past 20 years, but someone like Tara is not gonna be saying darn or shucks or stinkin', you know. She's gonna have a foul mouth. And it really got me that she was talking like an 8-year-old from a 1960s show about a small town.
Like, well, it's somewhat realistic. Did she have those fake swear words when she was with Slade or when she was with the team?
With Slade, too. She also says maybe. Everyone says maybe. M-E-B-B-E. And the... I got used to it until at one point near the end in chapter 7 or 8, Slade says it. Maybe. And then he says maybe in the same line of thought.
Mm.
And it's like, pick one. Just pick one. But there was something about the slang used in general that I found very off-putting for this.
Yeah, and I mean, that might be a combination of late 80s and, I think, older writer trying to sound like a teenager. You know, I think that comes out sometimes, too. Which, that is a difficult thing to do. I mean, if this is supposed to be a book about teenagers targeted towards teenagers or slightly younger, like, dude, I don't even know what the fuck teenagers say these days.
Yeah, me neither.
I work at a university. I don't know what the fuck teenagers say. So, I mean, if I were writing comics, I have no idea how they would do that. That's its own special hurdle to go through as a writer. But so let's go ahead and talk about these characters. Is there anybody that stuck out for you that you like, not attached to necessarily in a positive way, but like put an image in your head?
Vic.
Oh yeah?
I don't know why, but he was just like really, I felt like he was a character that was easy to relate to, and it's not necessarily because he did anything. He just seemed really chill and friendly, and he pointed out that, you know, not everyone lives in a super nice apartment. He had real life problems, and even though they didn't go into him very much, I just found him to be, like, I guess affable, right? He seemed like a cool guy.
Yeah, you know, I really did like that scene where they went to his apartment, because you go to Donna's place and it's this big ass penthouse. You go to Garfield, it's this mansion. And, you know, Robin doesn't have a penthouse or something to go to, but Robin's in the tower, you know, like, or when they go, doesn't Robin have like an office or something that Slade breaks into?
I think that's his like, I think that is his apartment.
I mean, it's not a bad place, but like you go to Vic's place when you get off the bus, because you're taking the public transit there. When you get off the bus, it's going to be, like, there's, like, a strip club right when you get off the bus in Vic's apartment, you know? And I like you say, I really like that he represents that normality that these other characters don't have.
And the best part, too, is, I mean, you could go a very bad way with this and say he's in a bad area of town because he's an African-American character. But no, I mean, he's obviously capable of living in the tower if he wants to. He's a Titan. And he specifically says, this is the place my dad grew up, and it was good when he was there. They all got out, and now it's time we come back and do positive change. And that's something a hero would say.
Yeah.
And it's totally believable that this guy lives here because he wants to do good in a community. And I like that.
It's not even something a hero would say necessarily. I remember, God, it must have been months ago, I was listening to, I'm going to sound really hipstery, I don't know. Listening to This American Life, and they had this episode where they talked to like this family in Chicago with this high school that had like a lot of shootings, right? And they had the kid talk to the father, and the father had no idea how bad the neighborhood was. He had no idea that the kids were shooting at themselves. He didn't even know they had guns. And the father was like, this is a good neighborhood. Like, I was raised here. My father was raised in this neighborhood. Like, this is our home. You know, and that sort of sense of tie to the community, like you could hear in his voice, like just the sadness of that image of that neighborhood that he had in his head being shattered. And it's like, it was so depressing to hear. And then he said something along the lines of what Vic says, you know, like, well, now that I know this, what am I going to do? I'm not going to leave, you know, like leaving would be the opposite of the right thing to do. Like what I need to do is be here. And we have to focus on making this place better if it really is as bad as my kid is saying it is. Like, not only is that a heroic thing to say if you're Cyborg, it's a heroic thing to say if you're a dude living in a neighborhood. Like, this is my home. This is where my ancestors are from. It might just be some fucking uptown neighborhood or whatever the fuck. Or downtown neighborhood, I guess. Upstown or whatever. It's some fucking shitty neighborhood, but it is my ancestral home, you know? Like, my grandfather was here. My father raised me here, and I'm raising my kids here. That's four generations of my family in this fucking neighborhood. You know, like that tie, I feel like it's broken all the time in these comics. Like people just move around willy-nilly to wherever a hero's needed. And so it was really interesting to see how he stayed there. And he even says it's not necessarily to, like, fix the neighborhood, but it's the family thing. And you get senses of him having these weird ties with his family.
Yeah, that's actually something about him that I'm definitely more interested in because of the things that were presented in this comic. Yeah. Like, what's so awful about his grandparents?
And what did they do to his dad?
Yeah, I mean, he acts like they're criminals for traveling, but isn't that what you do if you can when you're old? Like, yeah. You don't have to raise your kids anymore.
That's how you retire.
Yeah.
That's the whole point.
It's weird.
Anyway, David, who did you latch onto? Anybody?
I don't know. Nobody really jumped out. None of the main Titans really jumped out at me. I think... I don't know.
You didn't have a thing for Dick?
You were saving that up, huh?
Oh, I can't wait to say Dick a million times in this episode. As awkwardly as possible.
The two characters I liked, though, were... I liked Jericho a lot. And I liked what I saw of Jericho, and I really want to know more about him. I just found him to be as a character that needs to be who is completely mute is a interesting kind of I just like it's an interesting thing to see in comics. George Perez mentioned something about him in the intro about how so George Perez created that character, and Marv Wolfman continued to write him, obviously, but but George did not allow Wolfman to even write thought balloons for Jericho. We do get like one thought balloon, I think, here. Or maybe it's a narrator talking about what Jericho's thinking, but he doesn't have his own thoughts aren't like communicated to the audience through he doesn't have a voice. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I found that to be very interesting, and so that's a character I would like to know more about.
Yeah, I hadn't even noticed that there weren't thought bubbles or text boxes or anything telling you what he was thinking.
You know, I don't think I would have noticed it either unless I had, without having read the intro.
Yeah, and I read the first paragraph and then it TLDR'd it.
Yeah.
I at first I was going to do that too, but then I was like, you know, I'm going to read both. So I read the Marv Wolfman one and the George Perez one. And there were cool little tidbits like this and the thing about the X-Men and stuff. The other character I liked, and maybe I'm biased towards this character because I like him in general. I really like him as a character in other DC comics, is Deathstroke. Here he is definitely pretty pervy.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
Pedophile. I mean, we're assuming that they have a sexual relationship, even though we don't see it.
Well, she calls him lover. His lover.
Yeah, and you know, so it's definitely there. But I think I liked the emotional roller coaster that he was put through when he realized that Jericho was there.
Yeah.
So, because he, especially in later comics, like in Identity Crisis, where we see him, was it Identity Crisis where he takes on like a bunch of Justice Leaguers?
Where he takes out the Justice League for the Calculator.
With Dr. Light. Man, two pervs took out the Justice League.
Oh God, that's right. A rapist and a pedophile.
So, but anyways, he's like a stone cold killer at that point. And he is in Villains United, which is one of the spin-off series from Infinite Crisis. There we go, mentioning Infinite Crisis again. But here he isn't like that. He is a... you know, he's lost Grant, the original Ravager, so he's lost a child at this point. He's divorced, and he even though he is definitely a bad guy, but he's not a supervillain for supervillainy's sake. You know, he's a mercenary. He doesn't want to kill the Titans. He captures them, and then he's ready to get paid and just wash his hands of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what's interesting is that in my mind, I see him. I see the identity crisis, like Stone Cold Killer, Deathstroke. That's the picture I have in my mind. But he has like emotions, you know, more than just angry, negative emotions.
Yeah.
He's when he realizes Jericho is there, he pauses and he's taken aback and surprised, and you can tell that he definitely cares that his son is in this dangerous situation. And obviously that's what leads Jericho into controlling him. But it was an interesting look at this character that I've liked for a long time, but I had never actually read him in a Teen Titans comics. I'd seen him in the cartoon, and I'd seen him in other things. But this was a version of Slate I hadn't seen, and I thought it was cool. Like, aside from the pedophile stuff.
Well, you know what my favorite part of Deathstroke in this was? And it was simultaneously my favorite part and my least favorite part was getting his backstory. I think the backstory was not woven in very naturally and took way too damn long. And I think Dick Grayson even says something along those lines. Like, yeah, my God, you wasted all that time.
Yeah.
Which was great. I was like, thank you for saying that. Oh my God, this happens all the time and nobody ever points it out. Like, you just spent 30 minutes having a discussion while he's out there ready to kill people.
Yeah, but I think the worst example of that we've seen is Namor. But
oh God.
Yeah. Go ahead.
But even though there was all of that, what I really thought was fascinating was the commentary on how he got to where he is. And that he isn't necessarily, like you say, he's not evil for evil's sake. And we know here that he's not even really necessarily evil. He's just doing what he was always trained to do. Like, he was an army kid, you know, he practically lived on a base. He signed up for the military younger than he should have. And the only thing he ever did with his life was follow orders. And they even Wintergreen even says, like, I had to save him because he followed orders so blindly. Like, he had no autonomy. And so then when they cut him loose, it's an interesting subtle commentary on, like, on veterans. And when we cut these people loose after this has been their entire life, and we don't give them a support structure in any way, because Slade gets no support from the military here. They cut him loose. They say, go live with your wife. Here's a house. Whatever. Bye. We're going to give you this adrenaline thing. Didn't work. Sucks for you. Bye. You know? And it's like, and from his perspective, what, he has no purpose then. He has, sure, he has a wife and he has kids, but the wife even mentions, like, you love your fellow soldier who saved your life more than you love me. Like, she recognizes that. She says it to Slade and she says it to Wintergreen. Like, he means more to you than I ever did. And even though Slade has all those pictures of his family everywhere, the one relationship that he managed to save is Wintergreen. It's the one who's still with him. Everybody else left him. But he was the one we're saving. And I really love that there was that kind of subtle commentary in there. Like, is Slade evil or is the system that created him maybe evil? Or maybe not even the system, but like, they just cut him loose and there he went. And they expected it to just dissipate and not create Deathstroke the Terminator. Like, you pump this guy full of weird drugs, shit might happen, bro.
Yeah, he does become evil, but he's not there yet in this comic. And so this is something I'd like to go back and find out, is like, how does he get to that place?
Well, I mean, what happens to Jericho? I don't know what ends up with him, but I don't really see him very much.
I think he dies.
Yeah, and I don't know what happens to his wife, but I'm willing to bet she dies too. In which case, it's real easy to go down that road of evil.
and he's almost, Deathstroke's almost a noble character here. I mean, aside from the huge red flag, he's kind of noble. I mean,
carrying out his son's contract.
He carries out his son's contract. When he realizes Jericho's in that situation, his focus then becomes protecting his son.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of killing the Titans. He's not like, oh, the Titans escaped. Let me twirl my mustache and try to kill them now.
He's like, oh my god, my son is alive.
Yeah. And Wintergreen's, like, love for this guy is, you know, maybe we're biased towards Wintergreen's nobility because he's British, but...
Well, you have to do something to earn that kind of
debate. Yeah, yeah. And we see him be a heroic character here. You know, he puts his life on the line to save his friend against orders and all that. You know, he's not even in the military anymore, but he takes it upon himself to go save his friend from a bad situation. So I think there's a lot of good things to say about Deathstroke here.
Yeah. I gotta say, I'm not really split, but I will say that I'm split between two people. I really liked Donna Troy in this, not because of anything she did necessarily, but when we met her intended, her fiancé, I realized, my God, he's a normal guy. He's just a normal dude who happened to meet Donna Troy and woo her.
Yeah.
And I realized, this is the first time I've ever seen in a comic book a female superhero being attached to just a normal dude.
I can only think of one other example.
Who is it?
It's She-Hulk was engaged to Wyatt Wingfoot at one point.
Oh, but that's even Wyatt Wingfoot. He's part of wasn't he part of Howling Commandos?
I guess so. I don't think he was a superhero though. I have to look it up now.
But I mean, maybe not like a superhero, but like some kind of established character on their own, some level of badassery. I'm not sure, but that name sounds familiar to me other than just their attachment. But that might have come afterward, too. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I was going to say Steve Trevor, but he's kind of he's in the military and he was like assigned to Wonder Woman.
He's more of a sidekick almost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sadly.
Yeah,
it's more of an I Dream of Jeannie kind of thing. Actually, it's a lot like that, come to think. But, like, I realized all the time we see male superheroes with female normies, right?
Yeah.
Or muggles, whatever you want to call them. You know? Like, Superman, Lois Lane, Wally West gets Linda Park. Like, it's normal woman, superhero man, but we never see the alternate. The alternate is always superhero woman, superhero dude. And I don't know what kind of commentary could be built on that, but when I saw this, I was like, wait, holy shit. And then I had this sudden realization. I was like, dude, Donna, thank you. Thank you for giving a normie bro a shot. You know, like, on just that level, you know, like, that's awesome. And the other character that I latched onto, obviously, was the pervy Garfield Logan, because he and I share a bond, I think.
And you're both kind of creepy sometimes?
Oh, I'm more than just sometimes, brother. But... What I liked about him was that he shares something with Tara. Just the opposite side. They both get out of control. And Garfield does it from a sense that he thinks is fun. But he gets out of control real quick. The same way that when they're fighting, Tara gets angry, and then she gets rageful, and then she gets wrathful. And she loses control real quick. And I think that it was really interesting when they had their fight and they showed you that directly. Except you see later on how it hurts the people in Garfield's life. Like Garfield at home, nobody wants to go to him. None of the female people that work in the house want to go to him. I mean, for God's sake, the maid even said, what did she say? Why didn't I listen to my mama and become an exotic dancer? What?
The maid? Wasn't that Tara?
The maid says that.
Yeah,
yeah.
When she's told to go find Garfield. She says, I would have rather been an exotic dancer.
Okay, is it just me or did that maid look exactly like Tara?
It might have been.
They were both blonde and, yeah.
Both blonde, same haircut, probably same build.
Because the way I saw it is, like, they had the replacement butler at the time, so he didn't know who should be on staff. So it was almost like she came in to, like, infiltrate or something. I don't know. It could have just been coincidence.
Oh, maybe. I don't know.
I thought there was a devious plot there.
But that wasn't the only time. We see a lot of times where people are like, oh, God, I have to interact with Garfield, and I have tits. Oh, no. you know? And like it's comical for us, but that's super damaging, you know? And that's, mm-hmm. that shows that he damages the relationships all around him. And you can imagine, like, when you're reading this, I was like, no, he might have genuine affection for Tara, but there's no way that any self-respecting female would put up with the way that in front of her, he flirts with other women. Like, he does it a lot over the course of this comic. If he kisses her and there's supposed to be a thing between them that he, like, he has this whole scene at the end, and maybe it's his way of putting distance, all of this, whatever he does, who cares, but, like, it's almost difficult to read when those scenes happen. It's like, bro, you just kissed Tara last night like it was something special, and now you're hooting and hollering, like, about Donna Troy. Or, even weirder, Coriander, who's, like, serious with your one of your best friends. Like, dude, you serious, bro? Are you kidding me with this? That's fucking terrible. But I think it's just because he's like, this is fun, I'm going to have fun, this is fun, and then it becomes damaging before he knows it. And I thought that was super interesting for a character who's just supposed to be fun. And so that's why I kind of latched onto him, because of the creepy thing.
I didn't even think about him that way. I thought he was just, like, campy.
He is super campy. He is. He totally is, like, 95% of the time. And then you see the maid who says, I would rather been a stripper than be this kid's maid.
That's not a good thing to say.
That line, like, my jaw dropped. I was like, holy fucking shit, did they really just say that?
I mean, it is true, I guess. One of the first times we see him in his civilian, like, life, we see him sexually assaulting a teacher.
Yeah.
So,
That's fucking... That was awkward to read, too.
Yeah. That was really bad. Like, it was just over the top, too. Like, I don't know. Like, more over the top than his other stuff.
Yeah.
It's interesting that we get a lot of this...
That we can pull it out.
Well, that it's in the comic, you know, like the Garfield's behavior towards the teacher, the relationship between Deathstroke and Tara. It just seems like we wouldn't see that in a comic nowadays, at least not a mainstream Big Two title, you know?
Yeah.
That's directed at a younger audience.
Or, you know, I think that you would, but it would either happen too slowly or too overtly. Because I noticed something when I was reading this. There's text boxes here that eliminate the need for an entire frame of art that today would be drawn. Like, there's a couple times when Jericho and Dick are dicking around, heading into the base, right? And, like, there's a text box that just says Jericho puts his hand on Nightwing's shoulder in a, like, you know, in an acknowledging, knowful manner, right? Or whatever. Yeah. Nowadays, that would be an independent frame, and they would show you Dick's shoulder and Jericho reaching his hand up to it, you know? And then, like, the reaction, like, the look of Jericho's face, like, yeah, I know it, I got you, bro, we're same wavelength. And then another frame of Dick saying, all right, cool, let's keep going. Like, it would be three frames, and here it's just a sentence, and I think that this comic is very efficiently written that way. And that's something I noticed when I was reading this. I was like, that would be like fucking three panels these days.
You know, I didn't realize that those narration boxes were doing that, but I did kind of notice that there were some jarring jumps in the narrative.
Yeah.
As far at least from the visual narrative, like even from page one, we see them fighting in the snow. They're like fighting these random soldiers for Brother Blood, and then the next page it's like this huge flash panel where they're inside the base, you know, it's a two-page spread, like everybody's in action poses flying around, and it's like you didn't even see them get in the building.
Yeah.
So,
or like later on
there were a couple examples of that where it was kind of like a jarring transition.
I know exactly what you mean. There's the scene where they're fighting Brother Blood in the pool of blood, and all of a sudden they're encased in the shell that Tara made, and I'm like, it took me, I had to go back between those panels to figure out what transition happened. Like, wait, did they go under? Did they go over? Is the shell doing this? Is the shell doing that? Wait, what? Oh, I see what they did there. Like, it took a little bit sometimes.
Yeah, definitely. The fight scenes were probably the worst, too, because it, like, actually required narration sometimes for you to understand what was going on. Like, at the end where Terra starts encasing people in mud to suffocate them, she has to do her, like, evil laugh, here is my evil plan speech.
Yeah.
So that you actually saw what was going on. Because you never actually see the action, you see still frames. And it's actually really weird, because I think really early on, the first action panel that we get, it's a two-page spread, the writer kind of acknowledges that this is a commentary on the art. They're not necessarily, like, the same entity, because he's like, you know, and a picture is worth a thousand words, and so's this one.
Oh, yeah, I remember
that.
And
he refers to the art itself, and that's a breaking of the fourth wall that we, like, never see. So, yeah.
And it doesn't happen again in this either.
No, but I think it's where we get that jarring sense from. The art and the words kind of exist separately here.
Yeah. So, I think we've been dancing around her. Let's talk Terra.
We kind of skipped that, but yeah.
Yeah, we need to get to Terra, because we've been dancing around her. And we'll get to the villains later after this as well, but we really do need to talk about Terra.
So, I just want to put it out there. I think she's a horrible character. I don't just mean a bad person. She's a poorly done character. There's no motivation. Like, I would at least get it if she was at least like, you know, I came to teach you guys a lesson. Slade had his thing, and I just wanted to help him and show that you guys are chumps or something. But the whole explanation is that she's crazy and that it was her own fault that she was like this. That's actually directly said, it's her own fault. So we go one of two ways with this thing. Either you're painting a really poor picture of mental illness and how people do, can, and should cope with that, or you just said she's crazy because you don't have any feasible explanation for what's happening, which I think is actually, it's the latter point that is occurring here, but oh my god, that is just such bad writing. Like, oh, she went crazy and wanted to kill everyone. What? No. No, that doesn't happen. Nobody does that. No one's just, like, evil like that. She's not even mustache twirly evil. She's point... There's no driving force there. Rant over.
Well, you know, I didn't get the whole thing with the mental illness stuff, right? And now that you mention it, I do recall they did call her a sociopath once or twice in here, I think. Which, that leads to a misconception about psychopathy and sociopathy. Those people, while that demographic does tend to have a higher tendency towards crime, that they're not evil. They don't have hatred like this, the way that this comic portrays them. That said, I actually find it interesting to have a character that's not some kind of non-corporeal entity like a Phoenix or a Galactus, or not even Galactus. Even Galactus has a motive. They've explained why he does what he does. There's never hardly a human who just is consumed with hatred and anger, and maybe they've forgotten why they are even so full of hate and anger. Like, functionally speaking, if Terra's been so angry and so hateful to such a degree for so long that she's forgotten why she became that way, it doesn't matter then why she became that way, because she's not motivated by those things anymore. She's just hateful. And I think it was really interesting to see that in a human character. And I agree, it could have been maybe done a little bit better, but I did like that. I did like the idea of there's just somebody who's just so wrapped up in their idea of hate that they can't escape it, for better or for worse. And that the fact that she was surrounded by possibly the most accepting, supportive group of heroes she could possibly have gotten in with. I mean, there's nobody who would have given her a better shot or supported her better than the Teen Titans. And if that can't save her, then nothing could. She's just succumbed to hate. And I think it's interesting that we get that foil to Deathstroke, too, because Deathstroke here, as we've said before, like, he has reasons for doing everything to the point that he's almost noble. And he might have not even been a bad guy, in finger quotes, if he hadn't have delivered the Teen Titans to Hive. And it's nice that we get that kind of foil here. But, yeah, I didn't catch on to the whole mental illness thing.
See, what you gave there is, like, someone who has hated for so long and hard that they can't even remember the source of that. That makes for deep driving plots. That's like Javert in Les Miserables, right? We get classics built off of that. But, that's a good point. And maybe that is what Marv Wolfman is driving at, but I feel like it's not so well executed because if you look at it, she's portrayed as a bad girl the whole way through. So part of it could be kind of like, if you kids are bad and have sex with old men and smoke a lot, you're going to turn into a crazy bitch.
And wear makeup.
Yeah. And wear makeup. Yeah. She's like so whorish or something. And it's like, it just snowballs into like, okay, she's evil. Why does she hate them? We think it's going to be explained. Like, why does she hate Raven the most? What happened here? And it's not even, like, anywhere remotely close to that. There's no, like, sense of justice behind it or revenge. It doesn't even seem particularly personal. It just seems, at least to me, it felt very bitches be crazy.
Mm.
So I think that's my problem. Like, I needed a little more to make it feel like it was real hatred instead of plot device hatred, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's because this is, what, 6 issues? 7 issues? I think it's 7 issues. My math is hard. 6 issues. It's 6 issues. 39, 30, 40, no,
41. There's a chapter 7 title heading. I remember that definitely.
So we get 6 issues of her just being like, I'm going to be evil and smoke a cigarette, and then when I'm going to be do-goodery, I'm going to say, oh gosh, oh golly, right? We get 6 issues of that, and it talks about her being just hateful, but it's just, it's not really hateful at that point. And at the end, when we see her fucking lose it, like, oh, this is just pure empty hate. There's no motivation, there's no justice, there's no anything in this. She's just full of hate. And I think it makes, I think it's the vertical panels when she's lost it, and Marv Wolfman, as the narrator, is describing her empty hatred. And I think that page is done really, really well, because then a couple pages later, we get a similar vertical panel of Garfield crying over her body, you know? And I think it's like she's so full of empty hate, and these people tried to put so much support into her, you know? And you can almost see, like, well, she hates Raven the most because Raven's the only one who's not supporting her. Raven's the only one who says, I feel that evil in you. Raven's the one who catches on to it. And so you could almost build in your head this idea that she was able to sustain that hate because Raven didn't trust her. Or maybe she could have been, whatever, you know. But the problem is that I'm building all of that off of those 2 pages. In chapter 7, versus what you can't build off of the first 6 chapters of this, where that's just not present at all. It's only in that final scene that you get that kind of like pure hatred feeling, and it's like you can't retro write that in there, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. It needed to be developed more, and it could be that he got to the last issues and was like, oh, shit, I need to explain this. But who knows, you know.
Ah, Tara. So let's talk about the villains. Hive is faceless, right? I thought it was kind of...
In this comic, I'm sure they have more. There's more to them than this, but...
Yeah, and I like how in this comic, like, what was it with the guy who is, like, giving a speech, is giving like a PowerPoint flowchart speech. We've existed for 5 years. In year 1, we did this. In year 2, we recruited. In year 3, we lost a couple fights. You know, and it's like the company timeline.
Well, even an evil organization needs a quarterly report.
Yeah, and I like how they're like, we focused on recruiting. Okay, if you're gonna have a faceless villain, at least make it a little comical, I guess. But Brother Blood was like, I don't know what to do with Brother Blood in my mind. I think it's kind of cool how he's like, I'm going to sacrifice myself to allow my religion to spread everywhere because I'm just going to rise from the blood again anyway. But why? You
know, that plot, come to think of it, actually wasn't resolved, and I actually didn't remember that nothing really came of it until now. Like, you know, he dies, and they're like, and Dick Grayson's like, I don't think we've seen the last of him because he wanted that. And it's like, okay, we're done. We did see the last of him. It's over.
Yeah. Brother Blood got exactly what he wanted. His religion is now accepted all over the world. The dictator he hated, which, by the way, is the one who saw through his fucking evil face the entire time. The quote-unquote evil dictator was actually the good guy, but you managed to ostracize him and make him the enemy of the world, right? Like, Brother Blood won. He got every little thing that he wanted out of this, except for whatever his plans were from the Titans. I don't know. But, like, pretty much all of his goals were met. Which isn't what I expected, because his storyline started off with a really weird, like, television interview where they like satellite called him in to the studio. Fucking Brother Blood on live on Channel 3, an interview with Brother Blood and the Teen Titans.
Like, I'm amazed.
What?
Like, especially considering just the religious climate of America, that in this comic, a guy wearing, like, a fucking goat skull mask or something named Brother Blood comes on the TV and is like, join my religion. And all of America is like, yeah, that sounds like a great idea.
That guy's cool.
Yeah. What happened? And just because he's charismatic.
Yeah, it's like, does the name not give you any, like, tips there? Red flags? Or the skull mask?
Brother Blood?
The giant boiling pool of blood? Like, none of this stuff sounds really good.
Hey, maybe I'm stepping over a line here, but people seem to like people who get resurrected. Just put that out there.
That's true. Ra's al Ghul does have quite a following.
Yes, that's exactly who I was talking about. And Jason Todd.
Yeah, well,
Lazarus pits for everyone.
Wait, Jason Todd was in the Lazarus Pit.
I think he was in a cartoon movie, adaptation.
Yeah, because I think in quote unquote continuity, he was also universe punched back into existence.
Oh yeah, that's actually, you're right, by mistake.
Oh,
we should just read that damn thing and get it over with. Right, back to this comic. What did you guys think of them burying her as a hero?
It showed that the Titans were honorable. And I think they did the right thing. Because what good is it even going to do anyone to be like, this bitch be crazy, we hated her.
Guys, you know this girl that died? She was actually evil. But you had to be there for that.
And it would just make her brothers unhappy, right? Like,
yeah.
And maybe they'd go crazy too or something. I don't know. Like, it was a really nice thing of them to do, because they buried her as the person they wanted her to be. And I think that's what the Teen Titans is about. It's targeted at that younger audience, so it has to have those, like, anyone can do it, feel good vibe. And I don't know, it just encompasses the whole spirit of the team.
I thought it was cheap. I thought it was the easy way out for the Titans.
I think the Justice League would have done the same thing.
Probably. I feel like it's the easy way out. The easy thing to do is to remember her as everybody wanted her to be remembered, not rock any boats, and not reveal anything. But the problem is, it's also them not admitting their mistake. And them not admitting that they could be infiltrated so easily. And sort of them ignoring it in themselves. I was really like, I wasn't angry at Marv Wolfman. I think this is exactly what these people would do. But I think in doing it, it's not right.
I don't know. I think that naivete is essential to a team like that. They're they're meant to be kind of young and still learning, and we do see them grow up, and you know they're going to carry, like, this incident with them individually forever, especially Gar.
Yeah, definitely Gar.
But
yeah.
I just feel like it goes against what the Teen Titans is representative of. If they don't do something that, you know, kind of naive or fairy tale like, saying, well, let's not worry about this too much and just try to think she was a good person. Because I think, I don't know, I think it would be too dark. It wouldn't be what they stand for either.
Right. I just, it feels like they're taking the easy way out. And like, how are they going to follow up on this? Like, they say that Tara was angry and hateful for no good reason, right? But we get that from an omniscient narrator. How are these characters going to get closure on this entire ordeal without looking into it? Just a little bit. Like, are they going to go up to Geo-Force and be like, so, hey, did your sister, like, did anything ever happen to her when she was young? And they'd be like, we had a wonderful time growing up in a rich mansion as princes and princesses. Yeah, right, okay, but did she ever, like, get, like, beat up or something? Or why do you need to know if she got beat up? Oh, you know, just no reason at all. Like, they have a responsibility to find out how she got to be like this, to make sure it doesn't happen to somebody else. They have a responsibility. If they're going to honor her memory, they have a responsibility to find out how she got to be like that and how she ended up getting with Slade and how she was able to infiltrate them. They have a responsibility to solve this problem, and they're not doing it. They're just sweeping it all under the grave and saying, we're going to remember her as the woman everybody wanted. Like we're going to remember her the way that everybody wanted her to be remembered. And it's like, as a writer that's not lazy, as characters, that's lazy. They're choosing to ignore that responsibility, which is probably fitting for teenagers.
Yeah, it's their way of dealing with a death of somebody that was close to them, at least for a small amount of time. But also, like you said, it's kind of their way of sweeping their... I agree with you that it's kind of like their way of, like you said, sweeping it under the rug.
And I think they're doing it with the best intentions, but it makes me disappointed that they're going to keep it a secret from everyone. You know, like have the grave say what it says, have the public funeral that has everybody remembering her as a hero. That's okay, but they have a responsibility to themselves and to the people that were in Tara's lives to figure out what the fuck happened. You know, and it's disappointing that they gave that bright funeral to the people that should have gotten the truth. That's why I was a little bit disappointed in them. And maybe that's just, you know, you only have so many pages. You can't show two funerals. You can't do this. You can't do that. Like, maybe it is a writing restriction that you have to abide by. But it leaves me, like, it ends the comic on what I think was supposed to be a poignant note about the team. And I was like, whoa. Guys, that ain't right.
I can get behind that idea.
I don't know. I think it's interesting that we were able to take this book that we started off being like, what the fuck is with these nicknames? And like, pull all this like different stuff out of it.
Well, like I was trying when I kind of backed up earlier in the episode and said, I think I said something to the effect of, I didn't mean to start on a negative. And I said this is a serious comic. There is, because there's a lot here, you know. But there are distractions, and I hopefully will try to effectively reflect that with my rating when we get to that point. But yeah, you're right. There's a lot in this comic, and that's probably why it's considered one of the best Titans books.
Mm-hmm. So, all right. So let's move on to the art. All I gotta say is, word up to the best Nightwing costume of them all. The first, the original, the best.
It's only made better by the fact that it's presented side by side with Jericho.
Oh, God. Yeah, what the fuck was Jericho's costume from? It looks like a Bavarian prince, but superhero.
I'm pretty sure I saw it last time I went to Pride.
I just, hooray costume design. This is great. And then, yeah.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say Jericho's costume is pretty great with his, like, gem in the belt buckle and the purple and the blue little mini cape thing with the brooches. And then his mutton chops all topped off with a blonde afro.
Okay.
Yeah. It was, he just pulled that thing together. He looks very princely.
Yeah. You know what, though? The mutton chops and the afro, I was all down for. When I first saw him, I'm like, yeah, cool. This guy lives in the late 80s. It makes total sense. Like, that was fine. But then when the costume came on, part of me was like, that's fucking weird. And the other part of me was like, his power involves him not being in his own body. Why the fuck does he even need a costume? Just walk around in, like, a jacket or some shit. Because when we see you, quote-unquote, in action, we're never going to see the costume.
Like, he straight up disappears, which I think his costume's, or his power's pretty awesome in that regard. It's not like he loses consciousness and someone has to watch his body. He straight up disappears.
He is a fucking scary ghost guy. That's what
he's
he
like
is.
He's like a dead man that's not dead.
Yes. That's what I was just thinking. Which really, then, it's disappointing because we don't get to see that costume drawn more often.
Because I don't know. Like I said earlier, Jericho's one of my favorite characters in this, and his costume is a bit silly. Okay, it's a lot silly, but I still think he's cool.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that we get a couple panels showing him doing sign language, and like, I think it's interesting the barrier that Dick Grayson overcomes hanging out with him. Like, he says shh, and then he says, "Oh wait, I forgot."
What's funny about the What's funny about the side by side of their costumes is Nightwing's reaction to. His reaction is not, "What the hell are you wearing?" It's, "Why is Joseph wearing that uniform?" His mind just goes straight to, like, okay, he's wearing a superhero uniform now. Why is he wearing it? This whole scene is actually, I really liked it. The first panel after Jericho's taken over Robin's body, mm-hmm. Nightwing, the pose he puts him in is amazing. Where he's got, like, he's on one foot and he's, like, doing, like, a little kick out. It reminds me of, like, Looney Tunes or something for some reason.
That's amazing.
It's just a great pose. Anyways, I think we kind of talked about the art a little bit earlier, at least the transition of the panels.
Yeah, the action scenes and some of the paneling.
I thought the art was actually was good. I mean, one of the challenges as a writer is expressing the emotions of a character who's, going back to Jericho, I mean, there's a lot on George Perez to show what Jericho's feeling without saying anything, and I think he succeeds pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
he does facial expressions really well, I guess is what I'm trying to get at. To me, that goes a long way when talking about the quality of art, because this is a very visual medium, and when the facial expressions aren't dynamic or interesting, I think it kind of takes away a little bit of the comic, at least the emotional impact of the story.
Yeah, and it makes the job of reading the story less efficient if the art can't convey emotion from the facial work, because then the writer has to talk about the emotions of the characters instead of just getting to show them to you. Yeah. And there's some occasions in this where Marv Wolfman does talk about the emotions of the character. And then there's other scenes where you just don't have to. Like, there's the panel that sticks out to me in this comic is Gar just like doubled over Terra's body.
Mm-hmm.
Like that, oh God, that panel. And there was no words on it. And there wasn't anything saying what Gar was feeling. It was just like this guy who is creepy, pervy, straight up like sexually assaulting people. Like, you question him throughout the entire comic on whether or not he can actually attach to anybody or if he's just going to be fucking creepy with everyone. And then you see this panel like, oh, I was right and I was wrong about him. Like, in these ways, I was very wrong about him. Like, he does have this in him. He's not just the pervy guy who sexually assaults his teacher. He's also this guy. And it's creepy that he's both. It's hard to grapple with that he's both. But, like, there's no denying that panel.
Yeah.
And that just stuck out in my head. That, like, not only does that, like, oh, God, the emotion. But it's also like, oh, God, that character is... I was wrong and I was right. And, oh, God, Garfield. Is there any, like, panel like that that stuck out for you guys?
You know, I'm not sure. Like, I kind of felt the art was just okay. It wasn't bad, but looking back, nothing actually really stood out to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I could say the scene where Garfield is holding Tara, that was emotional, but at the same time, it felt, I don't know, just a little underwhelming for the emotional weight we're supposed to be feeling.
Because they share, I mean, it's, you don't see that relationship build. You see them share a kiss.
And then,
And then all the other characters also comment, like, oh, we didn't know they were that close.
Well, they weren't, but he thought they were. Or at least it was clear that he had something for her, the way that he tried so hard at the end to believe that she was not against them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, even that sense of betrayal from a friend is going to make you...
And he's the one who really reached out to her, too. And, like, when she was riding on his back when he was a giant bird, like, that scene, like, they all kind of reach out to her, but he's the only one who really made that effort, you know? And so, I mean, I guess there's little hints, but, yeah, there's not a whole lot that builds up for that scene. And so it doesn't quite get the payoff I think it deserves. But, yeah, you know, there's not a whole lot of the art that sticks out to me, other than Raven's face. I don't know what the hell is wrong with Raven's face.
Yeah, she looks really weird. She's not an old lady.
She's not drawn like that anymore. I don't
know. She was like gaunt, you know? Like her cheeks, her face seemed sunken in. Maybe it was, I mean, we don't know. She's kind of in a weakened state in this comic, and we don't have that context because it happened before this storyline. But
their fight with her father was before this, I think.
She looked really old. Yeah. Like Madame Web old.
Damn, that's how old.
there wasn't a particular scene that stuck out for me. Like I said, it was the details of the art made me like it. I try not to hold the coloring technology against comics from this age, and sometimes, you know, as a person who reads modern comics regularly, that is something that definitely stands out. But that's not something I'm going to hold against this comic. But if you're, you know, listeners, if you, you know, be ready for that kind of thing. I mean, that's something to keep in mind when you read any old comic. Yeah.
All right, let's get down to rating this, yeah?
Sure.
All right, Jen, how about you go first?
I'm going to give this a 3. I thought that the second half was substantially better than the first. If all of it had been like the first half, that would have bumped it down to a 2, because I have kind of really low tolerance for, you know, cutesy quips and 80s art and, you know, weird 80s dialogue. All of it combined tends not to be my cup of tea at all. But the second half, like, especially as soon as everyone gets kidnapped and Dick Grayson starts getting on the trail, suddenly became a lot more engaging, a lot more interesting plot-wise, and I feel like that second half actually gave us more substantial character development than we saw in the first half. And, I mean, for some characters, like, you get a lot more of Dick Grayson, and you get more of Tara and Gar. Everyone else kind of fades out in the second part, but, you know, that's okay. Like, they were addressed, and we know who everyone is by the end, despite nicknames. Like, we know their personalities and such. It was not something where I would say I want to go and read the rest of this run. At the same time, I'm not like, oh, you know, I fucking hate the Teen Titans. They're terrible. So, and it was actually a bit better than average. I thought the ending despite the flaws with Terra's problems and how they were depicted, was interesting, and everyone else's reaction was worth reading about. So yeah, a 3.
All right. What about you, David?
I'm going to give it a 3.5. I agree with Jen about the split between the first and the second halves of the comics. The conflict with Brother Blood, I don't think added much. It didn't add anything to this story, but there were bits. I get why it was included. There was bits in there where they introduced the relationship with Terra and Deathstroke. So even though it was kind of slow in the beginning, and I didn't really care for the Brother Blood stuff, like Jen, I really thought that the comic picked up a lot in the second half and really moved the story along. Overall, the story, the Judas contract story being the whole Terra betrayal, I thought that was really good. You know, the characters weren't portrayed perfectly, but, you know, I couldn't really tell you how I would do it instead if I was in Marv Wolfman's shoes. I think that the overall result was good. I think this was a pretty good comic. I didn't like this. I think maybe I liked the version of this from the cartoon a little bit better. It tones down a lot of the things that I didn't like about the comic, or the things that nowadays are maybe a little are off-putting. I guess they would be off-putting back then too, especially the weird, you know, the relationship with between Terra and Deathstroke. Yeah, so that those kinds of things are removed. So my suggestion is anybody who's interested in this should read this and then watch the cartoon too, because they're both valuable, and there's a reason why this is considered one of the best Titan stories, and I think it's good. I think overall it holds up pretty well, art included, you know. So yeah. 3.5.
God, you know, I'm so torn between you guys. I want to give it a 3.5 because I like the dichotomy between Terra and Gar, and maybe that's why Gar latched onto her, is because he saw that similar structure between them of both having the pattern of going too far in what is the signature of their personality, you know? And I like that the ending was something that feels true to these characters, but I could still get that hollow feeling from it. I like that Robin or Dick Grayson is able to be methodical, calm, show that maturity, and at the end of that little journey of his, then take on his mantle of Nightwing. And I like all of these things and the way that we're able to pull apart these characters that look basic and feel basic when you're reading it. They really, really do. But the more and more you sit and talk and think about it, you can pull all kinds of cool things out of it. Especially, God, Deathstroke and his backstory and the veteran thing. Like, that's, like, it's a subtle jab there at the way we treat our veterans. But that story went on for way too long, and I didn't care about the marriage. Oh, God, I didn't care about knowing about the relationship. You know? For all of the character stuff I love here, I feel like there's narrative structural issues. And I think that that's why the first feels wonky. It feels slow. It doesn't feel like it has its bearings the way that the second half does. The second half with Hive moves along with such a purpose. And the first half just doesn't. It just kind of meanders around, like, with this weird interview. And then, why are there senators? And they're going and, like, why does Dick Grayson have a disguise to bring the senators there? Like, that was a whole, what? I mean, I know why, because the senators are the ones that they threw under the bus in the first issue. And that's just kind of mentioned, like, oh, Senator Hitchcock, we're going to leak this to such and such press. And then turns out that leak was completely falsified. Oh, shit, our bad. I'm going to go undercover as a reporter and bring them to Brother Blood's island for some fucking weird reason. It doesn't matter anymore because they lost their seat already. You know, like, there's just weird narrative things that make me not want to give it a 3.5. I talk so much and I still haven't decided. I'm going to go with a 3. Because as much as I love these characters and the things that you can pry out of them, like, I feel like the things that I pry out of Tara's character at the end, being motivated just by pure hate that has lost its reason for being and is just hate for hate's sake, like, I love that we can get that out of that last book, that chapter 7, but we also only really get it out of that. Like, the entire rest of the time, we feel like there should be a motivation for it, and it's never explained that it's hate for hate's sake. There's never any lead that it's that kind of self-perpetuating anger until we get to the end, and then we see it. And it's like, God, I really wanted to have been there the entire time. So, yeah. 3 for me. Even though I did really, really like this, it's a 3. So that's it for the old stuff. Next week, we're moving on to the new stuff. We're reading Teen Titans. The trade is called It's Our Right to Fight. This is the New 52 run written by Scott Lobdell with art by Brett Booth and Norm Ratman. It's the first 7 issues. Our boy Norm Ratman! He's so cool. Yeah, first 7 issues. I believe the trade paperback's already out for sale. It is, right?
It should be, yeah.
It should be. Because it launched the same time Aquaman did, right?
I believe so.
Yeah, and the Aquaman trade's out, so trade should be out. But if you want to double check, or if you're not sure, or whatever, go to our website, www.atomicpoweredsupercast.com. On the right, there's a button to future shows. Click on that bad boy. There will be a little picture of the trade, and underneath there will be a little button that says Amazon. Click on that. It will take you to a link directly of what we're reading exactly. And, you know, if you think we picked the wrong 3 things to read for Teen Titans, if you think there's a better teen team we could have picked, I don't know. Or you just want to say, hey, what's up, guys? You can send us an email at
AtomicPoweredSupercast@gmail.com.
And please, you know, say what's up, too, on the social media stuff. It's at APSupercast at anything, you know, Facebook.com/APSupercast, Twitter, APSupercast. I even started an APSupercast Tumblr. There's nothing on it yet, but, you know, you can go follow it. If you follow it, I might put something on it and say, hey, what's up, to the one follower we get. And as always, please subscribe to us on
iTunes.
All right. Until next week, everybody. Go Sharks!
Goodbye. Also go Sharks. We'll be right back.